Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent Masla Mohammed. We are requesting that this court reverse Mr. Mohammed's convictions and remand for a new trial because his attorney was constitutionally ineffective when he failed to pursue a meritorious suppression motion that would have resulted in all of Mr. Mohammed's incriminating statements that he made at the police station being suppressed. While we believe that the record before this court today establishes all of our Strickland elements, we alternatively request that this court reverse the post-conviction court's order and remand for an evidentiary hearing to determine whether his decision to not pursue the motion was a valid strategic decision.
You characterize your first issue, Mr. Erickson, as withdrawing a meritorious suppression motion. Quite frankly, what troubles me with the way you frame that issue is it would require an enormous amount of fact-finding by this court to determine whether or not it was a meritorious motion or not. And we're not a fact-finding body. And part of the record were the statements, the body cam video or DVDs that were part of this. I've reviewed them. I don't know how we could ever engage in the fact-finding necessary to determine that it was would have been a meritorious motion warranting a new trial. I'm really troubled by the relief you're requesting from us on that issue because I don't know how we can make a meritorious determination to support your claim for a new trial without finding facts that aren't in the record for us to find.
Right, and under Kimmelman, this court has to first, the threshold question is to determine whether or not the statements would have been suppressed had he moved the court to do so.
What statements? The ones at the apartment, the ones in the at the police station, ones that were made after an officer said something, ones that the officer made after the appellant asked him a question. That's where I think the fact-finding part becomes so confusing. As a previous district court judge, I often had to sift through statements and decide which ones were made in response to interrogation, which ones weren't, what statements officers made that were likely to induce someone to make a statement, all fact-finding issues that the district court wasn't given an opportunity to make in this case. So I think that's what's problematic here.
Well, if I can unpack your
questions. There's a lot there, and I get accused of that every week, of having to unpack my questions. So
it's okay. So first off, this is a rare case, where there was absolutely no Miranda warning. So as soon as he is in custody, told he is under arrest, that starts the analysis of whether a Miranda warning should have been given at all. So our position is
custody is one factor, but it doesn't have, just because someone's in custody, the law is clear, you don't have to give them a Miranda warning until there's interrogation.
That's correct. Or functional equivalent of.
I agree.
And when he was arrested, placed in the squad car, at that point, the officer told him that he would only answer Mr. Mohammed's questions if Mr. Mohammed answered his. At that point, that started what is the equivalent of a custodial interrogation, and there was no Miranda warning. Our request is a clear line that everything that he said at the police station should have been suppressed had it been requested. So as far as fact-finding goes, if this was brought to the district court's attention and it was a summary denial like the post-conviction court did in this case, this court would have to do some fact-finding and determine whether the facts found were clearly erroneous. So the fact that we don't have a great record by the post-conviction court doesn't preclude this court from analyzing it.
But didn't implicitly the district court, I mean, I think the district court was the finder of fact at trial, correct?
Correct.
And also, and same post-conviction judge.
Yep.
So, I mean, doesn't the order denying the post-conviction relief, you know, in fact say it's error to assume that these statements would have been suppressed had that motion been presented to me? It seems to me there's some implicit finding by the district court. Is there something in the record that, in terms of the facts, that you would point to say that that's clearly erroneous?
Well, our position is that the legal findings by the post-conviction court were clearly wrong. I mean, the court analyzed this under Paul, which is a case just like Innis, where there were multiple Miranda warnings and the defendant invoked his right, and then it was whether or not you know, who started the conversation subsequent. That analysis is not applicable in this case because not a Miranda warning.
Well, but isn't the question whether there was interrogation or not? That was also at issue in Paul. That's what the district court cited Paul for, wasn't it? About how do you decide who initiates a conversation?
Right, but that's not the analysis when there's no Miranda warning at all, because it doesn't matter. Mr. Muhammad could have initiated everything, and they're still required to have a Miranda warning. You
can't. But there has to be interrogation, and that was the district court found there wasn't interrogation, correct?
Kind of. I mean, the district court found that Mr. Muhammad initiated the conversation.
And his statements were not in response to any kind of questioning.
Right, and that is clearly erroneous. I mean, if you look at the record from the beginning when he's at the police station, one of the first things the police officer says to him is he's going to be in custody for a long time. He's not going to get a bail hearing until later that week. He tells him how serious the charges are. They go back and forth about that. At minute 20, there are clear questions, statements challenging Mr. Mohammed's integrity, how he acted, what took place. They're talking about the specific facts of the case. And I won't get lost in this, that there was no Miranda warning. This is a very rare case. We're not talking about whether Mr. Muhammad asked a question or made a statement or even at some point said things that he probably shouldn't have said. At that point, the officers have to, one, provide a Miranda warning, and two, not respond. They have the duty to not respond to him at that point if they think that they don't need to get more Miranda warning. So as far as factual findings, this court has to review this very, short order by the post-conviction court and determine whether any implicit factual finding was erroneous, which it was, and any legal findings were also error, which they were as well, because they analyzed it incorrectly.
So if we get to your alternative theory that the court erred by not granting an evidentiary hearing, what's the issue, as you view it, at the evidentiary hearing that the court would hear then?
Our position is this court should, no matter what, rule on the Miranda issue because it's a legal question. The only thing that would be relevant at that hearing would be whether this was reasonable trial strategy, whether the investigation, whether the attorney knew that he wasn't Mirandized, whether the attorney knew the law on Miranda and whether or not he actually had to initiate the conversation.
Well, the record supports that when the lawyer withdrew the motion, he had the reports and he had the body cam videos. So it seems clear that he would have known there was no Miranda warning at that point. So assuming he knew that, he's not like some cases that have been cited where the officer or the lawyer was clueless. This lawyer had the reports, he had the body cam, and he made a decision to withdraw a motion to suppress the statements. How is that not reasonable judgment of a lawyer that would go to their trial strategy in this case?
Well, one, all of those are assumptions. We don't know any of those things. The motion filed, the reason why I'm using the verb withdraw is because there is something in the record. We don't know what that motion was. It's boilerplate. He uses the wrong pronoun. He refers to my client as a she. It seems from just reading that short motion that it's a Scales suppression motion, that he had not received the body cam at that point, and there were statements in the criminal complaint from my client, and that once he got the videos, we're assuming that he withdrew the Scales violation because there was no Scales violation. We are assuming that he didn't know there was a Miranda warning. We are assuming that he understood the law. None of that is in the record. That short statement he made about withdrawing this motion, there's nothing to it. And I strongly believe that this court, based on the record, that we don't need to have a factual finding or a evidentiary hearing to determine whether his decision, his choice to withdraw the motion was strategic. I think that's our last resort, is to have that hearing. Everything is before this court to rule on the suppression motion and to determine if all of those statements were suppressed and all of those statements couldn't be used by the prosecutor in her closing argument. All of those statements wouldn't be able to be used in the court's order finding him guilty. Does that fall below a reasonable standard? And I think the record is clear that that's true. It does fall below a reasonable standard. And we know that there was prejudice because the court's order included these statements and found Mr. Muhammad guilty, the specific element of the mens rea element that he knew that she was physically helpless was based entirely on these statements. And if you read the prosecutor's closing argument, the whole theme is her statements.
But weren't there also observations by the officers at the scene and of EB's condition, and there was evidence that, you know, drug evidence on, you know, alcohol use and marijuana use and Xanax or something else. I mean, there was other evidence that she was not in a position to consent, wasn't there?
For other elements, right? There's a specific mens rea element regarding Mr. Muhammad. The state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he knew at the time of the sexual acts that she was physically helpless.
And don't the observations of the officers at the scene and the subsequent drug testing suggest that he did that? Couldn't that evidence be used to prove the mens rea element?
I think that evidence established that she possibly was physically helpless, and they could argue that.
Right.
But they used his statements to say, look, he knew she was intoxicated at the time because he said that during this statement.
Said talk to her tomorrow because she's...
Right. And the whole point of Miranda is to protect somebody from trying to dig themselves out of a hole. At this point, those statements are inherently unreliable because he, at that point, is arrested, he's told he's facing serious charges, and he's trying to convince the cops at that time that he should not be arrested and that he's innocent of these charges without any warning that everything he says is going to be used him at trial and was, in fact, used against him at trial.
You're suggesting that had he been given the warning, he might have stopped talking.
That is what the purpose of the warning is. This court doesn't need to make a determination of whether that's actually going to happen or not, but that is what Miranda is all about, is we're going to tell you that before you say anything to us at this point, that we can use these statements against you to convict you of these crimes.
Do you have a case that supports that contention? Because my understanding of Miranda is that the warning is not required until there's interrogation or the functional equivalent. So... I don't think tell me if there's a case that supports the proposition that once he was under arrest, he had to be given this warning so he didn't start blurting things out.
I don't think there is a case because that's not the standard.
That seems to be what you're arguing, though.
Our argument is that the circumstances, the fact that the police officer said in the car that in order for us to answer your questions, you need to talk to us. Mr. Muhammad requested an attorney at that time. We look at this from the perspective of Mr. Muhammad. Does it seem like it is the functional equivalent of an interrogation? All of those circumstances support that theory. Absolutely, you're correct, that if they would have arrested him, brought him to the station, sat quiet, and he just talked, there would be no argument because there would be no functional equivalent of an interrogation. But what happened in the cop car where the police officer told him that he needed to talk, along with everything that took place in the police station, those circumstances created the environment of the equivalent of an interrogation. It doesn't have to be cops yelling at him and demanding that he answer questions. It's just the environment that he's in at that time. And if you want to parse out the statements, once we get to about minute 20 of the conversation, the officer is yelling at Mr. Muhammad. He is demanding that he answers his questions. He is criticizing him. He is comparing himself to Mr. Muhammad and saying, here's what I would have done in this situation. You didn't do that.
Yeah, there's no way
that can be not the equivalent of an interrogation.
Yeah, I think the judge acknowledged that perhaps there were some things that was said that shouldn't be. There's also numerous points in the tapes where the officer's telling him to shut up, stop talking. So that's in there also.
Yeah, but again, there was no Miranda warning before that. If there was a Miranda warning when they first started this conversation and Mr. Muhammad invoked his right to remain silent and said he wanted an attorney and then he kept talking, that would be one thing. But that's not what he does not have the information that he has this right.
Are you acknowledging then that the statements he made in the apartment before he was put in the squad car, there's no issue with regard to those being admitted here?
No issue. He is not told he's under arrest until right before they leave the apartment. Those questions that they're asking him at that time are about the initial investigation, trying to get his name, trying to figure out what's going on. I wouldn't even say he was in custody at that point. Until they actually tell him, you are under arrest, and then they don't give him a Miranda, and then they bring him to the car, and they keep saying you're under arrest, and deny him his request for an attorney. I mean, again, that is strong evidence that Mr. Muhammad believes the situation is escalating to the point where something's going on where they're trying to gather information from him, and he wants to talk to his attorney. There's no Miranda warning. They get to the police station. Again, there's no Miranda warning. Again, at minute 20, they keep pounding him with these statements and criticisms about everything that may have taken place before, almost requiring him to exculpate himself, which, again, is what Miranda protects against. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I can wait to respond in rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Dakota County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. There are multiple legal hurdles that the appellant must overcome in order to reverse the post-conviction court's order in this case. One, appellant must overcome the presumption that we do not review trial strategy. Two, appellant must demonstrate the counsel's representation fell below the objective standard of reasonableness. Three, the appellant must also demonstrate that the suppression motion would have been meritorious. Four, the appellant must demonstrate that if the statements were suppressed, that there's a reasonable probability that the result would have been different. And lastly, as to the evidentiary hearing issue, appellant must overcome the standard of review of abuse of discretion and show this court that the
post-conviction court. Ms. Light, speaking for myself and not the panel, let's say for the sake of argument, I do have concerns about the Miranda issue. Mm-hmm. So then we would skip to the prejudice. And I have to admit, going in, I was rather reluctant to think there was prejudice based on the fact that, you know, the victim testified, there was his DNA, et cetera, et cetera. But then, as Mr. Erickson points out, and here I'm looking at conclusion 64 and 63, you know, the court concludes based on the credibility of the testimony, which I think a fair reading of the record would suggest both the credibility of the victim and the defendant, the victim was clearly physically helpless. And then 64, the court also concludes, again, based on the credibility of the video evidence, wherein the defendant not only changed his story of whether sex took place and what type of sex, but also told the police they shouldn't talk to the victim because she was too drunk, and the defendant reasonably have known the victim was physically helpless and incapable of giving or withholding consent. Again, assuming I have problems with the Miranda issue, it would appear to me that the court is relying in part on those statements in reaching its conclusion as to the physical incapacity of the victim. So it seems to me that could be two for two for the defendant. So why am I wrong?
I would agree that according to the conclusions of law in the court's order, that in part the court does rely on some of those statements. However, he is also relying on all the other evidence that came in, and there's overwhelming evidence as to each element of
but
criminal sexual
be,
conduct.
Wouldn't it be better, Ms. Light, let's say again, assuming from the argument that I think there's a problem and I think you know, the prejudice might be a problem. Wouldn't it be better to remand to the district court to say, okay, assuming you erred in dealing that Miranda should not have been found, or excuse me, that Miranda should have been given, now redo your order to make it clear to us that he still would have been convicted if you took out any statements he made during this colloquy with the police at all these various places. I mean, it seems to me that's a more careful approach, wouldn't it?
However, that's not the standard under Strickland.
Okay.
So the appellant must show that there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different but for these statements.
And how would we know that? How would we know that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if he's relying on some of the, it seems like the district court is relying on some of these statements to get him to the physical capacity issue.
Sure.
So how could we be convinced that, well, if you look at the other parts of the order, he really kind of isn't. I mean, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure I would feel comfortable, even under the standards you're articulating, that it's absolutely clear that, you know, he would have been convicted if you threw out all the statements he made.
And I would like to differ. I would say under the order that it is clear that all of the elements that the court found all of the elements of guilt absent, even paragraph 64. When you look at the testimony of the victim, who talks about her lack of memory, who talks about her level of intoxication, who talks about that she has no memory until the police woke her up, and when she woke up, she didn't even know that the appellant had been in the room with her. The evidence of a used condom on the floor, the evidence of them both being naked from the waist down, the evidence of the statements that appellant made while in the apartment. The standard for the element of no knowledge, it's know or should have known. So we don't have to know directly from the defendant what he thought the victim's level of intoxication is. When we look at the other evidence, we can clearly see that the court found that she was physically helpless, that there's video body cam evidence of how incapacitated she was. It took a long time for the officers to be able to get her to even respond on the bed. So I think looking at those evidence, that evidence alone would prove the element of knowledge.
So maybe you can help me understand, because in reviewing the record, it seems to me whether a Miranda warning should have been given, whether one shouldn't have, whether all the statements were admissible, whether some, whether none, those are issues that the district court wasn't given an opportunity to rule on, because they were withdrawn. And so the request or the claim on the post-conviction issue is whether or not this lawyer's conduct in withdrawing that motion failed the first prong of Strickland, in that it the lawyer shouldn't have done that. When I review the record in terms of what the reason the lawyer put forth for withdrawing a motion, it's really confusing. I'm looking at page 32 in the first volume of the trial transcript. Says, "Your Honor, we did have basically a resolution of the contested issues. They were occasioned by me not having discovery at the time I noticed it up. It was a body camera videos, and it was related to statements. Now that I've had a chance to review those statements, the state and I resolved that issue, so there wasn't going to be a contested hearing." How did they resolve it? How do we know from this record, or how can we judge from this record whether or not this lawyer was exercising reasonable judgment when, at best, that's confusing. I don't understand. They don't say why. He doesn't say, mm-hmm. I don't think a Miranda warning wasn't necessary. I've packed a lot into that question, but, to me, the record isn't very clear as to why the lawyer did what he did.
Sure, and I would agree, and that would be the only issue for an evidentiary hearing to unpack if this court were to remand, but I don't think this court needs to do that.
And that's why.
Because trial strategy is generally unreviewable by this court. If we determine that whether to bring a motion to suppress statements is trial strategy, which the Supreme Court in Carradine stated explicitly, motions to suppress, whether to bring those forward or not, are trial strategy. That's a generally unreviewable decision for this court to because there's so much to unpack, because there's so much skeptical, reasoning behind an attorney's decisions while advocating and representing their client at the trial level.
But as a practical matter, what would a defense lawyer be thinking in letting the statements, particularly about the victim's apparent state, and don't talk to her tomorrow, she's messed up, or whatever the statement was? I mean, what possible strategy would that play into that could favor the defendant?
Well, again, this is... we're reading between the lines, and because we don't know directly from trial counsel what his strategy was, but I would invite the court to look at the trial transcript. And in the closing argument of appellant's trial counsel, he discusses the statements at length, and he discusses what was seen in the body cam video at length. He's arguing that the appellant was extremely intoxicated. He's arguing that they're both extremely intoxicated, that they were in a complete stupor. he's trying to get at that knowledge element. He's trying to advocate for his client to disprove the element that the appellant knew what was going on, that he was so intoxicated. Look at how he's talking to this officer. Look at how he's slurring his words in this video. So I, looking at the record on a whole, my presumption is that possibly his trial strategy was to go to the element of knowledge for criminal sexual conduct, and that's why he made the strategy decision to actually want those statements to come in so that he could make that argument in closing argument. Judge Flory mentioned earlier, the Miranda standard is not simply when someone is in custody, they must be given the Miranda warning. Miranda does not prohibit police from talking to suspects or even to arrestees. It's really only when interrogation or the functional equivalent commences that Miranda must be read. And here, when you look at the videos in the entire context of the back and forth between the appellant and the officer, you see that the appellant is the one incessantly re-initiating conversation, egging on the officer, trying to get a response, trying to get him to let him go, trying to get him to get a glass of water, trying to let him use the bathroom. You will see in the videos that the officer says, "I'm not going to talk to you anymore," and tries to not talk to him anymore. He says at another time, he says, "We're done," and tries to stop the conversation, but appellant keeps talking. And I do think, as the post-conviction court noted, you know, possibly some of the officers' responses may have been politically incorrect, may have been slightly inappropriate, but nothing that rises to the level of a constitutional violation. So when you look at the context of the entire exhibits, it's clear that the appellant is initiating all of the conversations. It's clear that there are spontaneous utterances and volunteered statements. For that reason, there was no interrogation, so a motion to suppress would not have been meritorious. Likewise, the appellant's trial counsel's strategy decision to withdraw that motion was objectively reasonable. There's overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case onto every element. So there's no reasonable probability that the suppression of statements would have resulted in acquittal. For those reasons, we would respectfully request that the court affirm the denial of his post-conviction petition. Unless there's any final questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Ms. Light. And is it L-I-G-H-T?
That's correct.
Thank you, Ms. Light. Mr. Erickson, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you. I just want to start with defense counsel's closing argument. He doesn't refer to any specific statements that Mr. Muhammad made at the police station. He refers to them both being intoxicated, which the record from the apartment clearly establishes. The best evidence that they were both intoxicated was the fact that the police officers found them in bed unconscious. He never says, "Here's a statement he made at the police station. You should look at this for knowledge." No, he doesn't do that. There's nothing about his defense that is focused on using those statements as a strategic advantage to Mr. Muhammad. This was just a mistake in my position. Our position is that the attorney made a mistake, and it was a huge mistake because it established an element in the state's case.
Are you suggesting there's no other evidence that sustained that element?
There's no other direct evidence of his mental state. And again, there is evidence of a sexual encounter. There is evidence that they're both intoxicated. But for a crime like this, a third degree criminal sexual conduct, and fourth degree and fifth degree, there has to be a specific mens rea element that the state has to meet for Mr. Muhammad. If two people, I'm not trying to criticize the victim by any means, but if two people are going to have a sexual encounter when they're both heavily intoxicated and both on pretty serious drugs, there has to be some sort of conclusion that Mr. Muhammad did something criminal, and the criminal act is him knowing she is physically helpless and then proceeding with the sexual encounter. And that's what this evidence established. So we're not contesting the rest of it. And the post-conviction court's finding that there's DNA evidence and the victim was credible, we're not challenging that at all. That's not what this is about. It's about whether the state proved his mental state and whether they could do it without his statements. And again, the defense attorney's argument was nothing about his mental state. It was that her not remembering is not the equivalent of being physically helpless. That was his whole defense throughout the closing argument. It had nothing to do with the mens rea element for Mr. Muhammad. As far as just labeling a decision as strategic, our Supreme Court case in Nix, a United States Supreme Court case in Wiggins, Strickland states it as well, is that you can't just label a decision strategy and leave it at that. If you're going to label it strategy, you have to determine whether the investigation into that decision was reasonable. And in this case, we don't have a record of that. And if this court thinks that that's what this case turns on, we need to figure out whether the defense attorney had the information in front of him, reviewed that information, understood what Miranda required, understood what Innes required, and just basically if he had a proper factual investigation into the case. As far as the post-conviction court's order to address Judge Connolly's questions regarding what the court would have done differently the next time, we have to look at this from an objective standard. The fact that he was the court for the court trial and the post-conviction court, the fact that he would make any statement saying there was enough evidence, if that's his subjective position, that's one thing, but it has to be an objective look at the evidence to determine whether there's a reasonable probability that this would be different. He has one line in his order saying that there was enough evidence without it. That's it. There's no analysis of the mens rea element. There's no analysis of the facts that support that. It's just a blanket statement that there was enough evidence to support the conviction. If this court doesn't have any further questions, we
Thank
request
you.
That this court reverse Mr. Muhammad's convictions or remand for an evidentiary hearing.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. Thank you, Ms. Light. The matter is submitted. Our last case this morning is Otto versus the Commissioner of Public Safety.